or even just turn the camera off.
Okay.
And not use the bandwidth. So you might be able to be heard better, but either way, whatever works for you.
But maybe turn your camera on just for a moment before your presentation so they can get the full effect of where you are.
Good morning. We're going to go ahead and get started.
Sounds good.
Can they hear us? Okay. Okay, good. Okay. Well, good morning. Let's call this meeting of the House Special Committee on Fisheries to order. The time is 10:06 a.m. Today is Tuesday, May 3rd. Members present at this time, Representative Story and myself, Representative Tarr. We do know Representative Price Tompkins is going to be joining us, and we expect a couple others as well. It's just that time of year where things are very fluid and moving around, but we're very interested in your presentation, and we at some point may get called away for a floor session, so that's why we want to go ahead and get started. We're thankful that we'll be able to record the presentations, and so if some of our colleagues don't end up attending today, we'll be sure to share the presentations with them because I know they'll be interested as well. Thank you so much to Shannon McCain, our committee secretary. Thank you. Doug. Thank you. I'm sorry. I was not thinking of that off the top of my head. We really appreciate your help today. And so today's presentation, Ocean Acidification in Alaska, Regional Conditions, Ecosystem Risk, and Mitigation Opportunities. So we have a number of folks joining us today. We're really appreciative of your time. Darren Pilcher from the University of Washington, Claudine Howry, pardon me if I've mispronounced that, University of Alaska Fairbanks, Tom Hurst from NOAA Alaska Fishery Science Center, Jessica Cross, NOAA Pacific Marine Environmental Lab, Darcy Dugan from the Alaska Ocean Acidification Network, a program of Alaska Ocean Observing System. So I think I'm handing it off to you, Darcy, to possibly get us started. And then if you want to hand it off, I think I have the order, but if you want to hand off to the next person after you, that'd be great. Welcome.
Great. Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. My name is Darcy Dugan. I'm with the Alaska Ocean Observing System and the director of the Alaska Ocean Acidification Network, and I'm coming this morning from the traditional homelands of the Dena'ina people on Anchorage. And the network formed in 2016 with the mission to help expand our understanding of ocean acidification, both the processes and the consequences, and also to look for opportunities for adaptation and mitigation. And there's about 30 researchers working on some aspect of ocean acidification in Alaska. Some are oceanographers that have instruments in the water. Some are marine biologists that are working on species response studies in the lab. Some are quantitative modelers that are developing forecasts. Some are grad students that are pioneering new ground with mentors. But I also want to emphasize that the network is not just researchers. We have across the state a very engaged fishermen and shellfish growers and tribal members and educators and resource managers and coastal citizens, and that we also consider you, the legislature, a part of the network and a key partner in addressing this issue. And we have tried to keep the legislature updated over the past few years because ocean acidification is going to affect Alaska disproportionately. And we'll hear more about this from our speakers in the next few minutes. I'll just note that we briefed the Resources Committee in both 2017 and 2018. The 2020 presentation got canceled due to COVID, and we're happy to be with you today. And I also want to note that the legislature did provide funding for ocean acidification about 10 years ago. It was seed money to start UAF's Ocean Acidification Research Center and purchase four moorings to start tracking change over time in Alaska, and we'll circle back to that at the end. But today we'd like to provide you with a short overview of the current state of the science and answer some of your questions. Madam Chair went over the lineup of speakers. It will start with Darren Pilcher, University of Washington, from University of Washington on conditions in the Bering Sea. So I'll hand it off to Darren.
Yes, great. Thank you for the introduction, Darcy. And I'd also particularly like to thank the committee for allowing us to speak with you today and for their interest in this topic. I'm going to start by highlighting current work and conditions in the Bering Sea. And I'm not sure, do we have the PowerPoint presentation kind of being run there, I believe?
We do, yes. Go right ahead. We have it.
Great. Thank you. Also, if we could go to the next slide. I just want to start with a brief refresher on ocean acidification. As you are all aware, humans have been emitting more and more carbon into the atmosphere through combustion of fossil fuels, and this has significantly increased the concentration of CO2 in the atmosphere. However, only about half of the emitted carbon actually remains in the atmosphere, with the other half being taken up by both the land biosphere and the global oceans. And because of this, the increase in atmospheric CO2 has been smaller than what would have been otherwise. So thus, these natural carbon sinks are providing this carbon and this climate mitigation service to us. But this can come at a cost. And in the case of the oceans, this cost is ocean acidification. So as the seawater or as the CO2 dissolves in seawater, we get this cascade of chemical changes that results in a net decrease in pH and carbonate ion concentrations for the global oceans. And we've already seen this occurring in the oceans at time series such as what I'm showing here on the left, which is noting the increase in both the air CO2, the respective increase in seawater CO2, and then the consequent decreases in pH and carbonate ion shown in that bottom plot. Next slide, please. And so this decrease in carbonate ion is important because many calcifying organisms use this to build their shells. And we've seen in both lab studies and in certain parts of the ocean that pteropod shells, which are these tiny sea snails that I'm showing in these pictures at the top here, have already begun to erode and dissolve under acidic conditions. And so in addition to pH, we often look at this variable called the aragonite saturation state, which is defined by that Greek letter omega. Because it provides this nice threshold for when the shell building of these organisms is favorable, i.e. when this value is above 1, versus when it's unfavorable, which is when this value is below 1. And this provides a nice broad metric for sort of the ecosystem status with regard to water core acidity. Next slide, please. We particularly care about OA in Alaska because Alaskan waters are already very cold and rich in natural CO2, which means that it takes just a relatively small amount of additional CO2 to push them into a more corrosive state. And so this is illustrated in this figure I'm showing here that's showing global values for this aragonite saturation state. And so you note that similar to temperature, it varies a lot across the globe, with the equatorial regions in general being much higher or less corrosive overall, but this value decreasing as you move closer to the poles, as you move poleward both north and south. Next slide, please. Furthermore, in the Bering Sea, we also see a lot of this variability in this from the surface to the bottom. And so what I'm showing here is observed data from 2008 in the North Bering Sea, illustrating that we're already seeing conditions well below 1 on a seasonal time frame. This is denoted by those very dark, cool colors at the bottom there, particularly on the middle and the outer shelf of the Bering Sea. And these are resulting from the seasonal signal of biology, where essentially at the surface, we get a lot of phytoplankton productivity that through photosynthesis takes up carbon and actually produces these very high values of omega, shown as those yellow colors at the very top there. However, as those phytoplankton grow and eventually die and sink down to the bottom, they get respired by bacteria. And that big bacteria mobilizes that CO2 that was taken up originally back into the water column, and then it produces those very low values of omega that we're seeing there. And so while that is a natural process, we expect that the spatial extent, duration, and intensity of those conditions is going to increase due to ocean acidification. And so a lot of my work uses the observational data, such as what is shown here, to develop computational models in order to track and eventually forecast these conditions. And the idea here is so that we can go from this sort of snapshot picture of conditions, which I'm showing here, and if you could go to the next slide, please, we can develop a more complete picture overall of the conditions. It looks like that animation might not actually be playing, but essentially, it's an animation showing the aragonite conditions throughout the Bering Sea, illustrating that during the winter, we get very low values at the surface, but then during the summer, we get much higher values overall as we get that boost in omega due to primary productivity. With these models, we can get a lot more information in space and time than we can with just the observational data alone. I'll catch up here. And then so we can use this model output as a tool to help us understand what the present year's conditions look like compared to a normal year. So here I'm showing the bottom water omega for just the Bering Sea Fisheries Management Area. And on the left is this as the 2021 anomaly compared to the long-term average. So essentially how last year during the summer, the conditions were different compared to a more typical year. And so in this case, we're seeing that, for example, the conditions near St. Lawrence Island were higher in this variable omega compared to normal, i.e. they were less corrosive overall, whereas the values on the outer shelf denoted by those more darker red colors were a bit lower than normal, denoting more corrosivity than normal. And so we use this information along with our colleagues at NOAA Fisheries to develop an index for the entire shelf. The idea being here that we have kind of this one-stop shop for denoting the overall ecosystem corrosivity that we're seeing for that year in the Bering Sea shelf. And I'm showing our iteration here on the right of this over time, which is essentially the percent of the bottom waters that are less than these particular values. So the way to read this is as this value goes up, the waters on the bottom shelf tend to be more corrosive than normal, whereas as they go down, they are less corrosive overall. And here I'm showing both that same omega equals one threshold in that lighter gray line, but also this black line of a pH of 7.8. And we're looking at that in particular because some biological experiments done at NOAA's Kodiak lab have shown that red king crab have negative effects to growth and survival at that pH value. So we're kind of tracking that as well due to its biological relevance specific for red king crab. Next slide, please. And of course, everything, oh, sorry.
Before we go to that slide, I just want to, on the graph we were just looking at. So in terms of the two things that you're tracking on this particular graph, is it, you know, they're sort of tracking together. Was that an expected relationship that you're seeing there?
Yes, great. That's an excellent question. I should have mentioned this earlier, but yes, this is indeed the case that in general, we expect that the pH values and the omega values will kind of co-vary together. They'll track each other very closely. That's true for the most part. There are a couple sort of odd instances, especially in regions with large glacial runoff, that might not be the case. But in general, we do expect them to be tracking each other sort of similar to what we're seeing there.
Thank you.
Thank you for the question.
Representative Story has a question as well.
Yes, thank you. Through the chair, you had said that the conditions were more corrosive than normal. And could you tell me why you believe that was?
Yeah, it's still something that we're looking into a little bit more right now. But our initial sort of assessment of it is that that was essentially an intrusion of water from off the shelf onto the outer shelf. So sort of how I mentioned earlier that one of the reasons these waters are more vulnerable is that they're kind of colder and more carbon rich in general. And so that applies to that water off the shelf in the deeper Bering Sea Basin, that it tends to be very old water, which also means that it's very carbon rich. And so just through different circulation patterns, sometimes you can get some of that water from off the shelf to kind of push and intrude onto the shelf, in this case, the outer shelf region. And because that water is more carbon rich than normal, it leads to these lower corrosive or these lower omega values than what we typically expect.
Thank you.
I think we're on the slide, projected changes to Bristol Bay Red King Crab suitable habitat.
Okay, great. Thank you. So we can also use this model combined with biological sensitivity experiments in order to project changing water conditions for a specific region and stock. So I'm doing that here for projecting habitat suitability for red king crab in Bristol Bay, using some of those same chemical thresholds that I was using in the previous plot. And these plots are illustrating the growth in these corrosive water conditions over time, but under two different climate emission scenarios. So the one on the left is a very high climate emission scenario, so essentially burning a lot of fossil fuels, emitting a lot of carbon into the atmosphere, whereas the one on the right is a more moderate middle-of-the-road emission scenario. And for these plots, I've also added another line, that green line, which is a pH value of 7.5. And that threshold in those same experiments was actually associated with 100% mortality of red king crab over 91 days. And so those are pretty extreme conditions for red king crab that you'll note we're seeing start to emerge in the more high emission scenario on the left, shown as that green line kind of ticking up towards the end of the century. But you notice the figure on the right, that doesn't happen, that those conditions essentially never emerged in that scenario. And so I like these figures because it's providing a tangible example of how emissions reductions, you know, can benefit our marine ecosystems, right? We're seeing sort of the version on the left, the growth in those, the orange and the blue line conditions going to nearly 100% by the end of the century, and the development of those very acidic 7.5 conditions. But that is not so much the case in the figure on the right under the more moderate emission scenarios. Next slide, please. And so I just want to end by saying that this is a very collaborative interdisciplinary effort. In addition to NOAA Fisheries, we are also developing these products for a variety of partners and stakeholders. And engagement with these stakeholder groups is critical because they help connect us with a wide range of federal, academic, commercial, and community members. And with that, I will end and thank you for your time.
Thank you. Appreciate it so much. Dr. Pilcher, I do have one additional question. If you can go back one slide.
Sure.
When we're looking at this, the RCP 8.5, RCP 4.5, is this, I was just looking it up to make sure I understand what that's referring to, the concentration of carbon that delivers global warming at an average of 8.5 watts per square meter across the planet. So that's the RCP 8.5 that you're using there.
Yes, sorry, I should have gotten rid of that lingo. That isn't correct. That is the kind of terminology for that scenario. Broadly, they're kind of consistent with a very high emission scenario on the left, and then a sort of moderate middle of the road emission scenario on the right. But that number is equating directly to the watts per meter squared of additional external forcing due to the rise in CO2 and other greenhouse gases.
And then, Dr. Pilcher, when you say, you know, that the high emission scenario and the more moderate, how does that track relative to emissions, you know, today, and then put it in the context of some of our emission reduction goals?
Sure, yeah. So right now, a lot of the emission scenarios haven't diverged a ton currently from where we are. They branch out much further over time. But in general, we've been sort of on track with the 8.5 scenario. And then to give a comparison of other scenarios, the more recent climate accord, the Paris Climate Accords, or more of the 1.5 to 2 degrees Celsius warming overall. Those are in the more RCP 1.9 to, I believe, 2.6 range. So those are more stringent, higher emissions reductions than what I'm even showing here in the 4.5 version. So sort of following one of those tracks, you would, you know, expect that to be sort of even a lower growth in these conditions than what the figure I'm showing on the right under 4.5 is.
I guess our takeaway should be then, you know, absent taking action, the scenario on the left is what is, you know, playing out with our current activities. And right, that's not so many years off where those green bars are very concerning.
Yes, yes. And I will note that, you know, there is still a lot of uncertainty in those scenarios. That's actually one of our greatest sources of uncertainty with trying to produce these projections, is just kind of what scenario pathway we're going to end up following. But I will note again that a lot of them kind of stay the same for the first initially, but they really start to diverge as we kind of push forward towards 2050 or so.
Okay, thank you so much. Any questions? Okay, thank you so much for your presentation today. Really important information. Thatcher, is that the next person? Okay, great. Claudine Howry, if I'm getting it right, this is going to go down as among my favorite presenter scenarios ever. Claudine is joining us today from a research vessel. So no one more in the field, okay, than you are today. Thank you so much for joining us. We really appreciate you taking the time.
Thank you so much for having me today. I'm very excited to talk to you about ocean acidification in the Gulf of Alaska. And I am actually in the Gulf of Alaska right now. We're currently conducting field work out of Seward in the waters of the Aleutic peoples. And in fact, I am on UAS research vessel, the Nanook, and we just deployed our carbon dioxide sea glider a few minutes ago. And so you can please go to the next slide. And I might actually turn off my camera just now because it will be easier for me to handle. Are you still there?
Yes, we're there and we understand. Okay. And let us know where to change slides.
Okay. Please change slide. It's also raining, so that's why my phone screen is a little bit messed up. But I'm just going to hold my phone and you will, I guess, still see me here. But yeah, we're currently conducting field work. We just deployed this novel autonomous vehicle here, the carbon dioxide sea glider, which can detect carbon dioxide, oxygen, salinity, temperature, and pressure, and also phytoplankton throughout the water column. And this was done with funding from the National Oceanographic Partnership Program and the National Science Foundation. And we developed this glider with industry and tribal partners. And we have been working on this project for the last 4 years. And we're now 1 year away from completion of the development project. And we have a big vision for the future to send out a fleet of these CO2 sensing autonomous vehicles throughout Alaska and beyond. And hopefully the CO2 sea glider will be able to help us fill important spatial and temporal data gaps that we have and improve our understanding of the current state of the system, and also help quantify CO2 sequestration efforts and possibly build an early warning system for mariculture. Please go to the next slide. But first of all, I want to take a step back. Why do we worry about ocean acidification in the Gulf of Alaska? Well, we care because some organisms are already negatively impacted by ocean acidification. And research suggests that ocean acidification, together with climate change, may lead to unprecedented changes throughout the ecosystem. Next slide. For example, these sea snails here, and Darren mentioned them already in the previous talk, sometimes may also, these research snails have shells made of calcium carbonate. And these shells dissolve once ocean acidification reaches a certain threshold. And so they can be used as indicator species for ocean acidification. And my colleague, Nina Bidnarsek, found sea snails with severely dissolved shells in parts of the Gulf of Alaska already. And this indicates that some waters in the Gulf of Alaska already reached thresholds that are harmful to certain organisms, such as the sea snails. Next slide, please. But the sea snails are not just an important acidification indicator species, but they're also an important food source for juvenile and adult salmon. And this is another reason, of course, why we should care about these findings and take them to heart. Subsequent presentations will focus more on the direct impact of ocean acidification on species, and I will just now dive deeper into current and past conditions in the Gulf of Alaska. Next slide, please. So as oceanographers, we use the spring water samples collected during research cruises, and we will actually do that later today as well. We also use sensors on more platforms, or now we can also use the carbon dioxide sea glider to collect ocean chemistry data to understand the system. Because of the data collected to date, we know that there are a lot of inputs into the Gulf of Alaska, such as freshwater discharge from tidewater glaciers and streams, and also precipitation that affect the chemistry, or circulation changes that move in water masses with different chemical properties, or, of course, also biological processes, as Darren talked about before, such as biological production that decreases the carbon dioxide in the water and thereby increases the amount of building blocks that's so important for organisms like the sea snails. However, with the data that we can obtain from these tools, we can only get a limited temporal and spatial context that oftentimes make it difficult to understand the process. This is especially true in coastal environments like the coastlands, where there are a lot of different processes that can change the ocean chemistry on timescales that are a lot shorter than ocean acidification. Next slide, please. So to supplement the observations and to get an understanding of how the habitat of certain organisms has changed over the last few decades, we developed a high-resolution regional ocean model for the Gulf of Alaska. The ocean model consists of a grid that spans across the Gulf of Alaska, and it simulates an attempt to reconstruct the circulation and biogeochemistry from 1980 through the present day. The model incorporates historic data such as historic wind and precipitation, air temperature, and also atmospheric CO2 concentration. And using these inputs, we can then simulate ocean circulation and temperature and salinity and nutrients and other biological processes and also ocean acidification. Over the last few years, we have been evaluating the model with available observations, and this helps us to understand the model's flaws and capabilities. Are you still there?
Yes. Yes, we can hear you.
Oh, good. Okay. Yes. Okay. And so now I'm going to use the model output to show you how quickly the chemical environment has changed since 1980. An interesting way of doing this is to see how much of the water column is still suitable to sustain the healthy sea snails that I was talking about. Next slide, please. This figure here focuses on the Chaya region, which is located off the coastal shelf in the Gulf of Alaska, so further offshore. And this is also where my colleague Nina Bnarsek found severely dissolved sea snails. We're looking at the percentage of the upper 50 meters of the water column that is still healthy for sea snails here in yellow. And the blue area represents water that triggers the shell to dissolve, and the red area shows water that causes severe dissolution in these shells. And you can see from this plot how quickly the healthy habitat shrinks over time from 1980 through 2013 or present day. And in more recent years, you can see blue and red spikes in the figure. And these spikes are so-called ocean acidification extreme events that turn the upper 50 meters of the water column into an area unfavorable for sea snails. This model finding aligns with the observed severely dissolved sea snails in the region. Next slide, please. These extreme events are driven by a combination of ocean acidification and natural climate variability. In multiple years in a row, the gyre in the Gulf of Alaska, which is this circular spinning ocean current, speeds up due to increased wind. And the enhanced Chaya movement brings up more carbon dioxide from the deep waters to the upper water column, creating these extreme ocean acidification events and conditions that are not healthy anymore for sea snails. Next slide, please. The strong Chaya also brings up water with low oxygen content, leading to low oxygen and acidification compound events. And here, this plot shows the oxygen concentration in color across the water column in the Shire from 1980, again, through present day. And the dark blue means low oxygen concentration, and the red means high oxygen concentration. Below the black line, there is not enough oxygen for most organisms to survive. And the red line shows the threshold below which it becomes dangerous for salmon. And the dotted line above shows the area below which sea snails are not happy anymore because the aragonite saturation state or the blocks are not available as much as they should be. So if we now look at 100 meter depth, we can see that there are times when the oxygen is too low for the salmon, and then also that there are not enough building blocks for their prey to thrive because of the issues of ocean acidification. And so next slide, please. So to sum up, extreme events have become longer, more intense, and more frequent because of this combination of ocean acidification and climate variability. So I just want to reiterate that we often think of ocean acidification as the slow-moving and uniform thing, but that is not the whole story because our chemistry varies naturally. And this is why it is important to understand how the ocean chemistry varies across space and time today in order to better predict how soon ocean acidification will threaten our ecosystems and also our livelihoods. Thank you very much for your attention.
Thank you so much for your presentation and for the work that you're doing. Are you available for any questions?
Yeah, I can be there for questions. It is pretty bumpy, so I don't know for how long, but I will try.
That's what I was wondering. Okay, if you hang in there, just let us know when you need to go. We're so excited to have you here. You mentioned at the beginning about the sea glider deployment, and I just wondered if you could give us a little sense of, at this time, what data are you collecting while you're out at this time? So when you come back, what will you be evaluating?
Right. Yeah. So we are with the carbon dioxide sea glider. We are able to collect carbon dioxide, so CO2 data throughout the water column, and so that will give us a much better idea of how it changes, mainly over time and space. Because the carbon dioxide sea glider can basically be out there during times when boats cannot be out there either because it's stormy or oftentimes, for example, we have data gaps in winter. And so we're hoping to send it out over the coming winter to get data that nobody has ever gotten, except for when there's a mooring out there at one, location. But the carbon dioxide sea glider will be able to, visit different areas and get us data that is very unique and novel. Besides carbon dioxide, we're also measuring oxygen and salinity and temperature and chlorophyll A. So just to get an understanding of phytoplankton.
Okay, thank you. And then you're on the Nanook research vessel that I think is now based out of Alaska. You're with the International Arctic Research Center. Who else is on the research vessel with you?
Do you want to see them?
Yes. We want to say hello.
So we have Andrew McDonald.
Oh, no. Moving may have disrupted your connection.
Oh, is the connection disrupting?
Okay. No, there we're seeing them.
And then we have Brian, our captain.
All right. Hello.
And we have Jöran Kemme. He's from Germany. He's our industry partner from the Sensor Company. And then we have Esan Abdi. He's also an industry partner from Cyprus. And he's our sea glider specialist. And then we have here, so besides the sea glider deployment, we're also going to do some tasks with the CPD for a sec, and we actually have another that we're testing on the Sea Glider. We also have it here on the Rosette. And so we're going to do profiles with that as well to test the response time and to see how it works going through the water column. And tomorrow we're also going to deploy a methane sensor on the Sea Glider, which I don't think has been done before. So it's pretty exciting.
Wow. Okay. Wonderful. So there's a crew of about 5 of you. And how long will you be out on this current mission?
So right now we're just doing day trips, basically. So we were out here on Thursday last week, but then the weather came in. And so today we're going to be out probably tomorrow again. We're going to send the glider out for multiple days and then pick it up again on Saturday probably. And the Tsikuliak is out here as well, the bigger research vessel. And they're currently doing, it's probably too far away for you to see, but they're doing the sewer line right now. So they're taking inorganic carbon samples and a lot of ecosystem measurements as well. So it's pretty exciting right now in the Resurrection Bay and in the Gulf of Alaska.
It sounds like it. Thank you so much. I hope everyone is very safe while you're out doing your work. Any questions from Representative Story?
Thank you, Chair Tard. No questions, but it's so good to sit here and know that this work is being done and you are providing us with valuable information. Thank you.
Thank you so much for your time. And we're actually getting a visit from Orcas right now, so that's exciting as well.
Oh, that's very exciting. Oh, wonderful. Well, thank you so much for your work. And please, you know, keep in touch as you are doing your evaluation. And, you know, we want to know what you're learning to help inform our work. So thank you.
Sounds great. Thank you so much. I think I'm going to sign off now. So thank you very much.
Yes, yes. That was excellent management.
Thank you.
I think now we're going to go next to Dr. Hurst.
Great. Can everybody hear me?
Yes, we can. Please go ahead.
Great. Thank you, Madam Chair, for the introduction and the opportunity to present what we've been learning about biological responses to ocean acidification among Alaska's fishery resource species. You go to the next slide, please. And so just obviously the goal of this broader work team is to understand the impacts of acidification on Alaska marine species and then forecast the effects, those effects on entries and communities. And so a little overview of what I'm going to present is some background in the basic understanding of what we know in three groups of fishes, crabs, or three groups of organisms, crabs, ground fishes, and salmon. The crab work is led by Chris Long at the Alaska Fishery Science Center lab in Kodiak. The groundfish is the work that I would lead here for my lab in the Alaska Fishery Science Center. And then the salmon work is work that's done in several venues at the University of British Columbia, University of Washington, and University of Alaska Fairbanks. And then I'll briefly touch on some research gaps and research vulnerability analyses that we're undertaking. So if you want to go to the next slide. You've probably seen images of this before, and it might even, the top panel might even been included in Darren's presentation, but this is a present slide that shows the effects of high CO2 or low pH on the survival of red king crabs in the upper panel and on tanner crabs in the bottom panel. These are juveniles. And you can clearly see in the upper panel that the low pH treatment, the sort of longer dashed line, has much, much higher survival. The crabs die much more quickly than they do at the control and intermediate pH treatments. And then you see a similar pattern, although not quite as extreme, difference among the pH treatments in the tanner crabs. And so, but in both species, we clearly see decreased survival at low pHs in these juvenile stages of these crab species. And this is exactly the data that was used to incorporate into the habitat suitability model for Bristol Bay red king crab that Darren presented in his talk. So you can see how the observations that we make in the laboratory are incorporated into and fuel those assessments that we make for organisms in the wild. And so if you go to the next slide. So we focus a lot on the mortality. It's a very easy parameter to incorporate into our models, but there's a lot more things that are going on beyond just OAs having an effect beyond just the mortality. So this figure is from another experiment in the red king crabs, where we see that the low pH is affecting not just the more survival of them, but also the growth rates of the ones that do survive. So in the solid line, we see the growth rate over time in terms of the mass, the weight of the animals, increasing over time in solid line at control and the dashed line at the low pH. And you can see that the control or the current ambient condition ones, crabs, are growing faster than the ones exposed to the low pH. And they didn't have good data for this for the even lower pH because all the crabs, as you saw in the previous slide, died during the course of the experiment. So they didn't get good growth rate data. So you can see how the effects spread out. Two of the main effects that we think of most clearly directly related to the productivity of crabs in their habitats. next slide. If you want to go to the next slide, there we go. Okay, so this is a pretty busy slide, so I'm going to take you walk you through it, but to make a few basic points. So this is a summary of all the work that we've done all the work that has been done so far on various crab species in Alaska. And the leftmost column shows the species that we've been working on: red king crab, blue king crab, golden tanner, and snow crab. And then in the second column is the life stage, where we've done a study of the crabs related to ocean acidification. And you can see for red king crab, we have it all filled in with some information about embryos, larvae, juvenile, and adult stages. But for other species, for example, blue king crab, we've only begun looking and have looked only at the juvenile stage so far. If you look across the top of the thing, top of the panel, and it's repeated across the middle, you see all of the kinds of biological responses that we've been studying in these different crabs. And so you can see the first two columns are the growth and mortality, and that's some of the data that I just showed. But then we see other biological responses that we look at to try to really understand what's going on with the crabs and get a fuller picture of how the environment is affecting the crabs. And so there's a wide range of responses that we've looked at in different species: respiration rates, feeding rates, condition, development, and then going across the middle, calcification, the strength of the scale of the shell, and blood and immune and gene expression. So you can see there's a wide range of biological responses that we're interested in, and we've been studying a number of species that we've been looking at in different life stages among those. And so there's a lot of boxes still to be filled in, but you can see for the most part where we have studied the effects of OA on these crab species, we most often see negative effects, and those are indicated in the red, the negative effects of low pH on crabs. We do see for red king crab, interestingly, calcification, we sort of see a slight benefit, and that's something that's still to be understood. But so one aspect, there might be no effect, but in other aspects of the physiology, we would see negative effects. So this is, again, a lot of information boiled down, but just to give you a broad sense of both the species we're looking at, the life stages we're looking at, and the kinds of responses that we are investigating in these studies. And then just a quick snapshot of, you know, the broad perspectives of whether they're having negative effects or we haven't seen an effect of that.
Dr. Hurst, I had a question. I wanted to welcome Representative Christ Tompkins, joined us about 5 minutes ago at 10:45. Welcome. When we have previously talked about ocean acidification, I guess I was sort of understanding that, you know, what we were thinking was most damaging would have been the exoskeleton hardness issue that was preventing the shell from developing properly. And so I'm just interested, you know, kind of looking at this, we do see decreased, you know, in the couple of areas where you have been able to study it, I think is what this chart is telling me. But what we see in the mortality column is, you know, a lot more information about increased mortality. I'm just wondering, how are you connecting the other physiological factors to their influence in increased mortality?
Great. Well, thank you. That's a really good question. A lot of times we are still trying to understand how these things all fit together. And so there are some physiological processes where the animals have a lot more control. And so they could respond to the poor conditions by changing their physiology. And that could be an example of the increased calcification of the shell of the red king crab as a response to the low pH that they're trying to compensate for that effect. But that doesn't completely overcome the other biological effects that might be leading to mortality. And I think it's so we don't usually know exactly how all the pieces fit together, but that's something we're definitely still working on. And so in these experiments, these are done in the absence of predators in laboratory tanks. So the mortality is not coming from the vulnerability of the shell in a predation encounter with a predator. These are two separate phenomena that are happening. The pH itself is directly leading to higher mortality of the crabs. And at the same time, the crabs appear to be trying to compensate for the weakening of their shell through additional calcification of that shell in some cases. So if that makes sense, but thanks for that question.
Yeah, no, very, very interesting. And in terms of the comprehensive approach where we would be able to look at all species, all life stages, is that limited right now by funding, research capacity? How should we be thinking about this? You know, in our term, you know, you're from a federal agency, but one of the things that we've been trying to think about is our role here as state policymakers. And one thing that's been clearly identified is research gaps. And so I guess I'm, you know, want to ask that question kind of in that context of, you know, your perspective on the state's role in helping achieve a more comprehensive approach and filling in, you know, the gaps so that we do have all species, all life stages.
Right. Yeah. That's a really good question. I think these experiments do take a lot of investment in experimental capacity and staff time and analytical capacity. So one of the things that leads to some of the gaps is because whenever we start an experiment, we have to be pretty cautious about picking and choosing which of the things we're going to focus on, because we don't usually have enough resources to study every aspect in every species at each stage. So we do an experiment with a stage and we kind of pick the things that, you know, we think will provide us the most information overall in the broadest picture. And so that's partly why we jump around a little bit from species to species to try to provide the broadest perspective. So we hope to fill these in a lot more as we go forward. There are some minor technical issues with, you know, the ability to rear some of these species in captivity, which, you know, I think probably is the biggest issue for the goldens and the blue king crabs. They're not cultured in captivity very effectively yet. But I think it's, you know, there's a number of labs that have some capacity to do this work throughout the University of Alaska system and NOAA's system. So we can do more of this work, but, it is inherently a little bit slower going than both we and you would like to see, I'm sure, because they just take time.
Thank you.
Through the chair, this is Darcy. I just wanted to make a note that we'll touch on this a little bit more about a potential role for the legislature at the end of our presentation as well.
Oh, great. Thank you. Okay, please continue.
Great. Thanks. And I'll go on to the next slide. And so this is just delving into a little bit more and showing you some of the more detail about that one of those other effects that, and the one we were just talking about, is how the low pH affects the crab shells. And you can see in the upper pictures on the left side is the left two pictures are the inside of the back of the crab's shell. And you can see at the ambient in the upper panel, you know, nice, clean, white, smooth shell on the inside. And then the low pH, the high CO2, you can see these erosional pits in the inside surface of the shell. And then in the right two panels shows the claw, the feeding claw of the crab, and the arrow is pointing to the denticles, which are the tooth-like things that the crabs use to crush their prey. And in the upper panel is the current condition, ambient ones. And then you can see when they've been exposed for a long time, I think this was about 2 years in this experiment, how those denticles are actually worn away. And so you can see how that might affect the ability of crabs to feed in the wild if they're exposed to those conditions for a long time. And so, again, these are things that don't immediately translate into kinds of habitat suitability models that Darren showed, but it's the kind of biological information that we have to draw to try to put all the pieces together and then use models to incorporate how this kind of effect might reduce the feeding capacity of the crabs and then further lead to reduced growth rates at low pHs. And I'll go on to the next slide. And so just a little summary of what we've learned on crabs. So far, we've seen that red king crab and tanner crab are more sensitive to acidification than snow crab and blue king crab seem to be. Interestingly, the larvae of crabs seem to be more resilient to ocean acidification than juveniles. And I think that's a biological effect that we probably wouldn't have expected when we began this work. So I think it is really important to understand there's some pretty basic patterns that we don't yet fully understand. Acidification induces a wide range of biological responses, you know, that we were just discussing, and that those vary across life species. So it creates that big, huge array of unknowns that we're going to try to fill in. And then finally, that we know that acidification is going to interact with other stressors. And if you want to go to the next slide, this is a graphic that illustrates the potential impacts of acidification with other stressors. So the things that we've been talking about so far are in that leftmost area, the direct effects of acidification on the animals that leads to decreases in growth, increases in mortality, and other kinds of biological responses. We also know that, and this is came up in Dr. Howery's presentation, that ocean acidification leads to indirect effects, and those are the effects on the direct effects on the prey of the species that we're interested in. So she talked about the effects on pteropods, sea snails, but we also are interested in lots of other prey species for fishes and crabs. And so we need to learn a lot more about that. And then finally, we know that ocean acidification is occurring at the same time that the ocean is warming in Alaska waters. And so there will be, we know there's going to be interactive effects between the CO2 and the warming that will potentially exacerbate one another. So basically make each of them will contribute to narrowing the range of optimal conditions for species. And and so obviously any of those three things or their combination, if they lead to decreased abundance and growth of the crabs, are going to lead to decreases in the potential for fisheries for them. And next slide. And this is just a quick illustration of the experimental data illustrating that point. So in the green line at the top, you see, again, this is the survival rate, the numbers of crabs surviving the experiment over time. In the green line is the normal conditions. In the pink line is the survival rates under reduced pH conditions. And then the red line is when we add on the elevated temperature to the reduced pH. And you can see, again, those two things together have a worse effect than either one of them on their own. And then we'll go to the next slide. So I'll go a little, just a little more briefly through the groundfish work that I've worked on. Mostly we've worked so far on three species, walleye pollock, northern rocksole, and Pacific cod. And it's good to know for walleye pollock, which is obviously an important fishery species, they seem to have so far be the least impacted in what we've observed. So we haven't seen effects on their eggs or size at hatch, and we haven't seen an effect on their larval or juvenile growth. We have recently seen some developmental biology effects, but it's, again, these are kind of effects that it's not clear how to translate them into productivity models, so that's something we're still working on. Northern rocksole is a mixed bag. We didn't see any negative effects on their eggs, but we saw reduced survival of the larvae. with higher mortality of larvae at lower pHs. And then in Pacific cod, we see growth and behavior effects, and again, in a kind of complicated pattern where low pH reduced the growth during the first 2 weeks of life, but seemed to increase growth during the next couple of weeks. And so we're still working on understanding what the cumulative impacts of those two differential effects might be. And then I haven't mentioned it earlier, but we also see in a lot of fishes an effect of low pH that alters some aspect of their behavior or their sensory biology. And that's something we have seen, an effect we have seen in Pacific cod. And the next slide. And so just quickly, some of the review of the salmon work so far. There was an initial study at University of British Columbia that found negative effects of high CO2 on the growth rates of pink salmon during their freshwater phase. And there's also work that, again, shows high CO2 effects on the behavior of salmon. And that work has been done both in pink salmon and coho salmon. That's work done at the University of Washington in collaboration with the Northwest Fishery Science Center. And there's a current project going on at the University of Alaska examining the juvenile pink salmon during their seawater phase, their initial seawater phase. And the next slide. And this is just a summary of that. This work is being done at the Aleutic Pride Research Center in collaboration with the University of Alaska Fairbanks. And the preliminary observations from that work suggest that low pH has resulted in reduced growth rates and condition factors, so how fat the fish are for their size, and increased levels of stress hormones. So that work is still ongoing. But again, there does seem to be some initial evidence of negative effects on the early ocean phase pink salmon. And next slide. And so just again, a little summary, we see a lot of variation in species sensitivity and the types of responses that we see in response to acidification at different life stages. Interestingly, crabs appear to be most sensitive at the juvenile stage, whereas fishes appear to be most sensitive at the larval stages. We know that the interaction with other stressors is expected to exacerbate the OA sensitivity, and we see a lot of that in both crab and fish studies. And then we're trying to, as I described, take this information and apply it to various kinds of sensitivities to predict the impacts on population productivity and fisheries and community. And next slide. Oh, is there a hand?
Oh, pardon me, Representative Christ Tompkin.
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair, and for Mr. Hurd. And forgive me if this is disrupting the flow and momentum of your presentation. But on slide 9 in the rearview mirror, and forgive me if I missed this in the verbal presentation, but the difference between 55% survival or whatever is indicated at, you know, circa day 180 on the x-axis for experimental yes. days, and 5 or whatever percent survival seems rather marked and notable. And I was curious, and again, forgive me if I missed this, but whether 7.8 pH and ambient temperature of 4 degrees Celsius over mm-hmm. baseline, how that relates to what are currently found in, say, Bering Sea conditions at present day, basically how that relates to what we are observing at present.
Thanks for that question. Earlier in the presentation, as Darren showed some of the patterns of what's going on in the Bering Sea currently. We do try to separate the two phases of this work to some degree. So because there's a lot of spatial variability, it's frequently difficult to, you know, do the study and pinpoint the conditions to specific places in the environment. So in the experimental studies, we cover a range of conditions and then use the modeling outputs and the observational data from the oceanographers to then translate those into the habitat suitability indices, you know, for specific places and how those vary over time and in space. So so obviously the normal conditions are what we're currently seeing. And then both the reduced pH and the and those are normal conditions in the Gulf of Alaska, in central Gulf of Alaska at Kodiak, using their seawater system there. And the reduced pH reduced by about 2.2 pH units, and the increased temperature of plus 4 degrees are things that we are not yet seeing, but those are things that we can then put onto the model projections to evaluate when we would start seeing those kinds of conditions that would have this level of dramatic effect, and in what areas of the either Gulf of Alaska or Bering Sea that we might start seeing those. So perhaps Darren could weigh in a little bit more if he has anything else, but there is sort of a, you know, inherent separation when we try to do the experiments under conditions that we know well and then map those onto the environments that we're seeing to put together the picture of how they fit together in space and time, if that makes sense.
Dr. Pilcher, did you have anything you wanted to add?
No, I think that's a great description that Tom gave there. Essentially, in our models, a lot of times we don't have the kind of fine scale resolution that we might need to know, you know, pinpoint exact locations of kind of what those conditions are. Usually we focus a little bit more broadly for like the broader shelf or broader regions of the shelf, just because we don't currently have that complexity.
Thank you. Yeah, I appreciate the response. I was wondering, you know, normal is a relative term, so I appreciated the tethering to present day. And also, apologies for my subpar 2020 vision. Mr. Hurst, I think I referred to you with a different consonant, so thank you for the answer.
Great. Thanks for that question. I think it's a really interesting point to make it, you know, just in the nature of how we conduct the science. So I really appreciate the question.
We knew this might happen through the presentation that we would get called to the floor. And unfortunately, the bells have rang. So we're going to need to wrap up in maybe, say, 5 minutes. My sincerest apologies. And so how we want to, Dr. Hurst and Dr. Cross, and then to Darcy, kind of split that time up. Please go ahead.
Darcy, do you want to direct us?
Sure. What if we go to the very beginning of Jessica's, and then I'll wrap up with maybe my last two slides.
And I appreciate where we ended with you, Dr. Hurst, slide 14, research needs. That was a specific question I had. So we can definitely look over that. And then did you want to just say anything about the regional vulnerability assessment project?
Sure. Just very quickly, this is a project that we're trying to do to tie all of these things in together to figure out with the community members how these things will all play out in their community and help them decide what they would like to do in response and how they will be impacted. And those could be helping them generate policy discussions or management frameworks or alternative industries that they can do locally. So you'll hear a lot more about that in the future. This is just getting off the ground, but I did want to take a moment to introduce it.
Thank you so much.
Thanks for that.
Welcome, Dr. Cross.
Good morning, everyone, and thank you, Madam Chair, for squeezing me in, even though the bells have already rung. I will be very brief with you. It was my intention to talk to you this morning about ocean carbon dioxide removal, which is a potential pathway towards mitigating ocean acidification risks. And it was also my intention this morning to talk with you about the role that NOAA is playing in this space right now so that you have a grasp on the potential work that could be scaled across the state. I'm not going to get into my slides. I'm very happy to share the script that I prepared to go through this material with you so that you can go through it at your leisure. But I do want to advance you all the way down towards the summary slide if I can, just so that I can hit the big points with you.
Please. Thank you so much.
Absolutely. So I was going to start out by talking about how the IPCC essentially says that in every scenario that helps us meet our climate goals, carbon removal is a part of that scenario. We need both emissions reductions and removal of legacy carbon in order to meet our climate goals. The advantage of carbon removal is that it can be used as an acidification mitigation technique. And this is being acknowledged by the current federal administration as well as by Congress. The IIJA identified that CDR is necessary, that CDR supports jobs and markets, and that CDR must be deployed at scale. I could have offered you a few examples of different kinds of CDR research that's currently being explored around Alaska, but I would have emphasized that this is in its extremely early stages and nothing is quite being implemented yet. I also would have shown you some information about NOAA observations and models that track the global carbon budget, as well as large-scale regional ecosystem assessments. I'm sure you're all familiar with the ecosystem assessments that inform the Fisheries Management Council every year. But I would have also emphasized that local information and local data collection is a gap in NOAA's work right now, and certainly would help to scale these efforts across Alaska. The last thing that I would have said is that NOAA's spatial tools are sort of focused on this local scale, even though our observations really aren't. And these could help identify the right places to deploy coastal CDR projects, both in order to protect existing industry and living marine resources, as well as identify where CDR might be the most effective.
Thank you, Dr. Cross. Very impressive summary. And I'm disappointed that we don't have more time because I'm very interested in this work that you're doing. So if you would be so generous as to share the script you were going to read from so we could learn more, I hope we can keep in touch with you and you know, continue to learn more about your work and inform our work and understand this potential as a mitigation factor. Thank you so much.
I welcome the opportunity to follow up with you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. And then Darcy, in just the last moments here, so sorry that we have to kind of rush through and wrap up, but thank you so much to everyone today.
Great. I'll just be really brief, just underscoring that there's a lot of groups involved, not all of which fit on one slide as part of the network, and we're continuing to explore ways to collaborate together, both with monitoring and engagement and education. And if you go to the next slide, we haven't touched on this today, but there are 20 communities across Alaska that have been involved in weekly water sampling for ocean acidification with the goal of trying to get local information on a regional level. And most of this is conducted by tribes through their initiative. If you go to the next slide, I'm just going to kind of breeze through these. But these are a lot of the questions that the network is hearing. Is it happening now and where? Will this impact subsistence? How might this affect my business plans? We're trying to do our best to synthesize information to begin to answer these questions. And then if you go to the next slide, this shows some of the resources that are available through the network. We act as a hub, so there's handouts. I was able to meet with almost all of the members of the Fisheries Committee last month, and we discussed some of these in individual meetings, but there's reports. We have an e-news if you're interested in monthly information of this nature. And there's also a discussion series that's taking place this spring. If you go to the next slide, these are some of the key information needs. And we can talk with you about these more after the session, probably also in the interim, but places that we need to understand conditions in important fisheries areas, more on the local drivers in the near shore, and grounding out our map of what we know across Alaska and how it's changing, since, of course, we have a very big state. And I want to highlight at the bottom on that map, it's from a study from 2015 looking at the risk of Alaska's fishery sector to ocean acidification. And we are due for an upgrade of this study. We have a lot more information now about species sensitivity and exposure, and also more socioeconomic data. And this could be a place for the legislature to help with funding. This is my last slide. If you go to the final one, this is one other place where we want to engage the legislature. In about 10 years ago, the legislature funded 4 moorings to start collecting baseline data, and 2 of those were pulled in 2016 without the funds to maintain them. And we are hoping to reinstall these existing assets. One could go into Bristol Bay, where we don't have any nearshore data, and that's an important area for the state-managed salmon fishery. and is also a key area for the most sensitive life stage of raking crab that Tom was talking about earlier. So anyway, we hope to work with legislative members to put something in the budget for next year, and we look forward to continuing to partner on this effort to address ocean acidification. So thank you so much for your time today.
Thank you, Darcy. Thank you so much to Dr. Darren Pilcher from University of Washington, Dr. Claudine Howery, University of Alaska Fairbanks, who joined us from a research vessel, Dr. Tom Hurst from NOAA Alaska Fishery Science Center, Dr. Jessica Cross from NOAA Pacific Marine Environmental Lab, and Darcy Dugan from Alaska Ocean Acidification Network, Alaska Ocean Observing System. Thank you so much for your presentations today. We'll look forward to continuing these conversations. We know this is an issue of great importance for our fisheries and the sustainability of our fisheries. So please know our door is always open to continue these conversations and look forward to trying to address these issues together. Thank you. With no other business to come before the committee, we are adjourned at 11:17 a.m.